Okay.
Okay, can
So
I?
this is our BIML meeting, and we are super pleased to have Melanie Mitchell joining us today. So Melanie's going to give some introductory remarks, and we're going to talk about a paper that we've read of hers.
Okay, so you have to give me permission to share my screen.
How do I do that?
You go down to share screen, and there's like a little arrow. And you have to scroll down and give permission to participants or something.
Oh, maybe under advanced.
Yeah.
I don't see it.
Are you the host? You're the host, right?
Yeah, I'm the host. Ooh, oh, that was wrong.
So you don't want to share your screen.
No,
you just want
I
to
don't.
Give me permission to share my screen.
And I don't even know how to undo that. Stop.
It's like an unshare. Yeah. So there's like a little carrot.
Is it under permissions or is it under? Oh, there we go. Advanced sharing multiple participants. Okay, now you should be able to do it.
Okay. Great.
Great.
Okay. So most of you have read this paper. I'll just say a few introductory things. You know, most of you have seen the Dartmouth summer research project on AI, where they were going to solve AI in a summer with 10 men, literally 2 month 10 man study. And they were particularly interested in a lot of the things that we still struggle with in AI, including forming abstractions and concepts. So it's still a very open question. And deep neural networks, which have done so much for a lot of fields of AI, still are very far from solving this problem. You know, we've all seen the, I'm just gonna go kind of fast through this. So, because I think all of you have seen this kind of thing with deep neural networks doing really well on the ImageNet data set and lots of other applications in AI. But the big question is, what exactly are these machines learning? It's hard to tell. Are they actually learning concepts like, you know, some of the, can't even see what these are, but like concept of and I'll talk about later, like a bridge. I think Gary's seen this before, but this is an example of a machine, a deep learning network that learned to decide if an image contained an animal or not, and did really well. But when this is one of my students dug into what it was actually learning, turns out it had learned that images with blurry backgrounds tend to have animals in them. Because, you know, the photographer is focusing on the animal. And that's just like one really simple example of this idea that machines are learning statistical properties of images that very often are not the concept that we're trying to teach them.
Melanie, do you remember Doug Blank?
Of course.
So Doug taught a neural network in the 90s how to recognize English words, and they were simple three-letter words. And he was looking for something like an English word is a consonant followed by a vowel followed by a consonant. And he trained his thing up and it learned the training set incredibly well. And what it learned is an English word is not a K followed by not a K followed by not a K. So, which was perfect. And we call this the not a K problem in our kind of nomenclature.
Or the KKK problem, right?
Exactly. We could call it that, but that's a little too scary.
Yeah. I'm going to skip this, but, you know, other people have shown things like if you take a neural network that's learned to recognize images in ImageNet, like fire trucks, with very high confidence, but if you Photoshop the object into different poses, it now thinks it's a school bus or a fireboat or a bobsled. And this just shows that these networks are very brittle. They're not robust in the way that humans are because they haven't really learned the concepts that we're trying to teach them. I'll skip this, but you've seen like the adversarial attacks on images and vision systems, like with the famous stickers on a stop sign attack that makes a vision system think that this is a speed limit 80 sign very confidently. So the issue really is that these networks are learning what we might call perceptual categories. They're not learning what we humans learn, which is what we might call concepts. So to give an example of that, if you consider the notion of a bridge, a neural network, deep neural network could probably learn, given enough examples, to recognize these things as bridges, but it wouldn't be able to recognize this as a bridge. This is a water bridge where it's a bridge for boats to cross a highway, and the bridge is made of water. Or a bridge like this with ants bridging a gap with their bodies, or bridging your hands, or the bridge of a nose, or the bridge of a song. You know, all these things are ways that we humans are able to abstract and generalize the concept of a notion like a bridge. You know, we talk about bridging the gender gap. We talk about, you know, Biden talked about how he was a bridge to a new generation of leaders. And there's just a zillion more examples. And Gary will recognize this as a very kind of Hofstadter kind of notion of concepts, that we're able to analogically extend them in this way almost indefinitely. And we humans, our intelligence is very much tied up in our ability to do this kind of thing with really any kind of concept that you
I don't want. Know, Melanie. I think that's a bridge too far.
Touche. So our buddy Doug Hofstadter defined a concept as a package of analogies, which makes sense, you know, given this, the examples I just showed of bridges. You can really do that with any concept at all. So the question is, how do we get machines to learn concepts rather than these perceptual categories that aren't robust and allow the machine to be brittle? And more centrally, in order to get them to learn concepts, how do we get them to make analogies? So what I did in the paper, and I would do in this talk if I was giving you an hour-long talk, but I won't, is survey some AI methods for abstraction and analogy, including, I don't list it here, but like symbolic AI, which I talked about in the paper, deep learning methods, probabilistic program induction, and my own work on copycat, which I can show you a little demo of if you're interested in later on. And then talk about the limitations of each of these different kinds of methods, because we really haven't solved this problem yet. And I don't think we're even close to it. But then the question is, how do we make progress in this area? And the last part of the paper is about some proposals for how to make progress on trying to study this in AI. So I guess I'll, you know, that's probably enough for an intro. And I'm happy to talk in more detail about any of these different methods and proposals. But since a lot of you have read the paper, maybe we can just stop there and discuss.
So one of the things that I was wondering about is how you chose the examples you chose for deep learning in the paper. And whether you think they're, I mean, in some sense, they're indicative of what's going on, but they seem, I don't know if they were the main examples that everybody else uses.
So what would you propose as the examples of deep learning approaches to these issues?
I don't know. You know, though we're concerned with representation, I guess there's the question is, how's it all tied up in representation, and where do those come from? How do we get to create those or not?
Well, I think most, you know, in deep learning, there's been the kind of approaches I mentioned, like with these Raven's progressive matrix problems and very related problems, which are clearly related to abstraction and analogy. Then there's been this work that I sort of vaguely mentioned on what people call meta learning, which is all about representation learning, you know, learning a good representation that rather than learning a specific task. And
that seems to me to be on a better track than the purely statistical approach.
Right, I agree. But the problem is that it's still kind of the kinds of problems that that's been applied to aren't really, I didn't find any applications of that area that seem like the kind of abstraction problems that are interesting in the way we're talking about. I think people will apply it there, but I just haven't seen that yet.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something notable in the paper regarding sort of the word, you know, the word analogy, not the concept as we are understanding it, but the word analogy and representation learning. One thing that is notable is that you sort of, you declare specifically that you're not going to talk about the proportional analogies, which received a lot of attention at some point as, you know, computers can now, you know, do analogies because, you know, king minus man plus woman is queen. I kind of agree that I don't know. I also don't know any sort of complex analogical deep learning approaches. We read as part of BIML and, you know, in other efforts, we started looking at, there was some work by Sanjeev Arora on linear linear algebra and polysemy, and it was using sparse representations of word vectors, where, you know, they did some kind of sparse code learning and came up with some sort of primitive meanings that could span, you know, in a sparse way, you know, some large vocabulary of words. And we were trying to use that actually at some point to do sort of analogical reasoning by taking the atoms and sort of freeing them. And so the sparse atomic decomposition would lead to, a few, a small number, a few, you know, 5 to 10 aspects of a word that could be used to compute similarity between concepts. And that way give us sort of a disentangled or faceted view on similarity.
Is that because you think that there's structure inside of the, like, substructure, sub-symbolic structure? Is that what we're really missing here?
I don't know. It was more to say that, you know, one of the statements that Melanie makes in at the beginning of the paper, right before she goes into the examples that she chose to describe, is it's really understudied, and it still is, I think. When I was reading it, my favorite examples were not necessarily the deep learning ones. It was actually, you know, SME and copycat. The contributions that they were making to this problem that we are interested in, regarding the impact of representation on what computers can do, it seemed more promising.
So I want to kind of get to that if we can. What's your view, Melanie, of where, what symbols are made of? Like that seems to be the thing. Like you can build sub-symbolic parts in a sparse distributed memory, like a Kinerva memory, that are, you know, it's the sparseness, but it's the overlap in between the sparseness that gives you some sort of sub-symbolic capability, maybe. Or you can build structures out of microcodelets, or blah, blah, blah. So, and sometimes it seems like neural networks might be able to learn some aspects of that if you force them into representations that seem that work. And I'm interested to know whether you think that the mathematical approach that is the most common will go anywhere, or whether it's just a complete dead end in terms of the subsymbolic pieces that you need.
Yeah, that's a that's the question, right?
It is the question.
I you know, one thing that's different, I'll say, that's different about copycat than all these other systems I mentioned is this notion of dynamically constructing a representation. Mm-hmm. And by dynamic, I mean there's actually time. Bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
You know, there's time, there's feedback, there's
building up and tearing down, parallel.
Yeah, there's an unfolding of perception and representation building, as opposed to most deep neural networks where it's all feed forward. You know, the system learns some weights and then it represents the entire input all at once, for better or worse, in terms of activations in its units, and then works on that representation. There's no sort of dynamic part of that. And I think that dynamic part is, and that's true of SME also, but that dynamic part is what's really missing in a lot of these systems.
I had a comment. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
I just had a comment about deep neural networks. Mm-hmm. Like, I totally agree that the ones that are purely feed forward, it seems like a really restrictive kind of limitation, but it's also really interesting to think of them as approximating a dynamical kind of process, I think. Like, if you know, you have like 24 transformer blocks or whatever that are all kind of doing the same thing, it's interesting to think of them as like kind of iteratively activating and refining concepts.
How do you think of them that way? I don't see how that translates.
Well, you can imagine training up a transformer with one transformer block that and shared parameters and iterating it. There are some papers on this. I can't recall which ones off the top of my head, but you just iterate the same transformer block on the input, and you train it to on whatever task with some variable number of steps. So it has to learn to be kind of effective wherever it stops, and then you can just run it recurrently for however many steps you want. So like you can, there's kind of a point being there's a similarity between just like a recurrent transformer block that would have that property of being, being able to run indefinitely and have the solution emerge versus just a fixed stack of transformer blocks.
Does the Hopfield architecture do that in your view, Victor?
Well, yeah, I wanted to bring that up too. Have you seen this paper, Hopfield Networks is All You Need, Melanie?
Yeah.
So I think that's really suggestive too, like the idea that a transformer architecture could be basically the stack of associative memories that are associating both the elements of the input and whatever information comes to be stored in those billions of parameters. So I think it's possible to kind of imagine a transformer being at least capable of doing something not totally dissimilar to what copycat does, like kind of iteratively activating these fuzzy sets of concepts and using them to refine, create relationships between the inputs, and eventually spit out at the end a version of the input that's been filled up with all the meaning it can squeeze out of there.
Sure. I'd love to see somebody do that. I don't think anybody's done that yet.
Well, I also wanted to bring up, like, so I think in your paper, you very rightly kind of demolished all these deep learning approaches that try to just generate, you know, like a synthetic task and like pull a million examples out of it and train on that to do analogy making, which is ridiculous. But I think it's very suggestive how much GPT-3 can do, even though it's still fairly dumb. You had an example in your talk last week with this burger restaurant thing, right? Where it was like it can spit out a bunch of, it can infer a lot of details about this little story, but then it can't really reason about it very well.
I love the shanky and move was just hilarious. That yeah. Very meta of you.
It still seems like such a much more compelling kind of attempt at abstraction and reasoning than any of those like training on a million Raven's matrices approaches, just because like it's going to take any shortcut it can, but the enormous scale just means that it's eventually going to kind of squeeze some abstracted concepts out of all the training data, because there's just, you know, it can't overfit basically. It's going to learn a million shortcuts, but it's also going to gradually assemble some interesting concepts. So the question is sort of, how do we make it, do that with less data?
I mean, I am both skeptical I'm skeptical of the some transformer sort of simulating the complex dynamics of copycat. I mean, the Hopfield paper, the Krotov papers have an interesting result, which is that there is a linear layer that can approximate the dynamics of these so-called modern or high order Hopfield networks, but those dynamics are still very sort of mathematical. They're defined, you know, by a single function. You know, it's still sort of an energy functional. So if a relatively simple sort of energy functional, and so yeah, you have sort of a forward layer that can approximate, you know, in one step, you know, iterative sort of convergent dynamics. The other thing that you were talking about regarding sort of GPT, I mean, what are we to make of the truly wrong, you know, inferences? I mean, what did the truly wrong inferences say about the representation of the story? What did it learn about the story when the person walks out of the restaurant? I mean, I think one of them is, did they pay? And the answer is yes, right? It's just remembering that, you know, that typically people do
mostly
that.
Mostly people, right? Do
but
that.
But I think we're projecting a lot onto it when you give it a prompt like this and ask it to solve a task just by completing the prompt, because it's only actually trained for text completion. So any ability it has to correctly complete a task that you've assembled as a prompt is sort of incidental. So I don't know if it necessarily... I think it's still very suggestive that it's able to manipulate abstract concepts and try to complete a text like this. Okay, and draw in so much context.
So let's let Melanie react to this.
Yeah.
No, this is fascinating. I don't know if you guys saw another article I wrote about getting GPT-3 to do copycat analogies.
I saw.
And it can do some of them. It needs a little training, you know, a few examples, but it can't, there's some that it can't do. So it's not like out of the box. As I think Dave Chalmers, who you probably many of you know, philosopher, who said that he thinks GPT-3 is like a step towards general intelligence. I don't know if you saw that article that he wrote, Gary.
Oh, where did he write that? Dave's always been wrong about everything.
Yeah, I'll have to find that and send it to you. It's pretty amusing. But he like jumped on my copycat analogy thing, and he's like, oh, it can do copycat analogies out of the box. It's amazing. But it's not true. It can do some of them, but not others. And it's kind of mysterious why.
But well, I don't think it's too mysterious, because in some sense you wired the concept map into copycat, you know, predecessor, successor, all of that stuff, the end points of the alphabet, all those things are constraints that you kind of wired into Copycat's mind. And we had to do that because that was the only way to do that back then. The question is whether you could, in some sense, train up that set of concepts into GPT-3 by saying, you're not allowed to wrap around, you know, all the stuff that kind of got built into Copycat to make it do the really interesting analogies that it does. So
I mean, it's interesting that GPT-3, you know, if you give it ABC changes to ABD, what does PQR change to? If you've given it a few examples of analogies, it can do it because it sort of gets the idea of successorship, mm-hmm. letter successorship. It knows that somehow. I don't know mm-hmm. how exactly, but it can't really generalize that notion very well.
Right. You couldn't say do that. You know, you take the Bob move and say do that. It would be like, what's that? You know.
Right. So I find these large language models kind of interesting, but they definitely are not there yet. They make so many mistakes. They don't, and it's hard to interpret like why they're making the mistakes they make, as Harold said.
So back in the days when Psyche, you know, Doug Linnett was working on Psyche so hard, I was always thinking, gosh, you know, if they just crammed enough crap in here with S expressions and the Psyche was just crammed enough crap in there and it interacted in weird statistical ways, maybe concepts would accidentally emerge from that gunk. So that's the other end of the spectrum. You know, you start with these brittle symbols, but if you put like literally billions of them together, and you shake them, then maybe concepts come out of the soup. And it seems like we have sort of that on one end, and then on the other end, we have deep neural networks just learning statistical associations in the input features, whatever those happen to be. And they're both moving towards this emergent subsymbolic computation idea, I think. But maybe that's just bias on my own.
How well, I don't know. Are the neural networks moving towards emergent subsymbolic computation?
I think the fact that GPT-3 can do anything at all when you train it on a couple of examples and do some analogy making a la Copycat is pretty impressive, really. It's surprising. Yeah. Like I'm surprised by what GPT-3 can do, even though I know what it can't and why it can't. I'm still like, holy shit, that goes farther than I thought it would have.
You know? Yeah, that's why it's so interesting. Mm-hmm. But it's, it's unclear, sort of, always unclear to me, sort of what things it's memorized that it's kind of using in.
Yeah.
'Cause it's memorized a ton of stuff, right? And we don't even know what it's memorized because there's so much data that it was trained on. And it has so many parameters. And is it fair, you know, you guys read the stochastic parrots paper probably.
Yeah, we did. We had a huge debate internally about that, sort of along generational lines, more or less.
Oh, interesting.
About whether the social justice work is, you know, good solid science or terrible, or how that shakes right. out.
But aside from the social justice part, is it fair to call GPT-3 a stochastic parrot?
I love it. I think it's a great caricature.
It is, but a stochastic parrot doesn't have any concepts.
Parrots are animals.
Come on.
Parrots have central nervous systems. They know some stuff, right?
but when they're parroting something you said, they don't understand it. I think that was the point.
Wait. That's not true. What about that one bird that they brought to Indiana and we watched it do like amazing things?
Maybe they understand it a little.
Alex. Alex was a genius parrot.
It was doing the red triangle problem.
Right. No, I agree that parrots are very smart. But I think when they, the stochastic parrot paper was using that term parrot in the dumb sense. It was like when you say something to your kid, like your 2-year-old, and they parrot it back,
right,
without understanding anything about what they just said.
Right.
We're not trying to disrespect 2-year-olds or parrots. it's just a caricature of it's parroting behavior that we're.
And by the way, on the social justice front, in the stochastic parrots paper, Maritza Johnson's going to join us next week, and she just sent the homework assignment for us to talk about. So she saw some of my commentary on our bibliography, and we've been talking over the last couple of weeks about kind of bias in AI and what that means. So you guys should be prepared for that next week, just so you know. I'll forward that email on. But I did find it interesting that, you know, as kind of a old white male rich guy, my reaction to the stochastic parrots paper was probably indicative of problems in the system, which Victor was gleefully pointing out as a young, not quite rich yet white guy. But it was it's a thorny issue.
Yeah.
Bias. Because obviously when you're training these things up, GPT-3 is being trained on history in some sense. Somebody wrote it down and coded it all in, and it happened or somewhere. So, and there's a lot of it. So all of those institutional biases are of course going to be built right in. Mm-hmm.
Does anyone remember, I don't know if this was in the GPT-3 paper or in something else I saw, I feel like I saw something about GPT-3 being able to use novel vocabulary. Like if you teach it a word in the prompt, it can then, you know, use that word and answer questions about the new word. Yeah. To me, that seems really suggestive of it doing a little bit more than just, you know, memorizing stuff, like just learning statistical regularities in the low level sense of this, you know, this token goes here because of this other token.
Right. I do think that it learns a lot about the syntax of language. And so it can use a new nonsense word correctly in English, you know, in the right English way. I'm not sure it can learn the meaning, you know. I mean, yes, yeah, sort of. I mean, I sort of remember what you're talking about, and it is impressive. One interesting thing that I learned at that meeting that you guys watched, or some of you watched last week, I don't remember when it was that GPT-3, that people have tried to kind of do a kind of large language models in other languages than English, mm-hmm. and they don't work as well. Which is weird. I don't understand that at all.
Is it because
the equivalent size of the data? Yeah,
exactly. Training sets are too small.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, when you compare like comparable sizes of pre-training, at least this was, I don't know where the citation was, but I think, I forgot who said this. Maybe it was Brendan Lake, that English has certain properties that make it more amenable to this kind of predictive autoregressive training.
Clearly the lingua franca.
Yeah, exactly. But if you try to do this in like Chinese or something, it doesn't work as well.
What does David say about that? Have you talked to him about that?
I haven't talked to him about that.
I wonder, because it probably doesn't work as well in English if you just use a different tokenizer too. I wonder how much of that, you know, might just be needing to hit on the right tokenization scheme. Mm-hmm. Or just needing the right kind of, you know, portfolio of little tricks to make it actually learn in a decent, reasonable amount of time.
Yeah, maybe that's more that bag of tricks is more advanced in English than other languages.
I certainly think that that's an underemphasized part of neural networks these days, is the amount of absolute kludging you have to do to make
it work. Totally.
When you start, and that part, just like everybody. That's the part we're going to sweep under the rug. No one right. Under the rug.
We do this kind of data augmentation for this network, but it didn't really work in this network. We don't know why, but we use this other kind. And
yeah, my favorite papers are the ones that say, so we set it to 4. And you're just like, what is it again? Empirically, they always say empirically. So we said it before.
Yeah, like, it worked. We don't know why, but
you did shit up until it worked. Okay,
it's totally alchemy. Absolutely.
So, can we talk a little bit about the program induction work that Lake is
doing? Yeah, that stuff is very interesting.
Yeah, the Dream Coder stuff in particular. I was hoping there was going to be more about that in the NYU thing. I was a little disappointed with that, the NYU session, just because I was hoping you guys would sort of duke it out as like people who think about this all the time, but it seemed to be a little aimed at the general public more than I wanted it to.
Oh yeah, 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 it was.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think the program induction stuff is really interesting. I mean, in some ways I've been thinking about how you could make that stuff more copycat-like or vice versa, mm-hmm. because, you know, that stuff, basically, they decide some probability distribution over possible programs, right? And then they do this kind of search using heuristic search methods to find the right program that works. But they don't do it in any kind of active way. It's right. Like the way copycat works, where you have sort of a network that's active. And I think you could actually do that for program induction.
Did you talk to Brendan about that idea?
No, I haven't.
Dream Coder sort of does that?
Yes, Dream Coder kind of does that by using a neural network to try and figure out what's the best thing to use. But I think you could make it much more. I think you could do it much more. It's kind of copycat-like with multiple competing possibilities.
So in your mind, the dynamism is tied up in this competition. That's the important.
Yeah. Thing. Yeah. I think the competition's really important. And I think that happens in our brains. I mean, I think that's part of why, how perception, high level perception works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And mm-hmm. I haven't seen that in like any of the program induction stuff, but I actually have a collaboration with Tenenbaum and Ellis, the Dream Coder people, to try and we have a grant proposal pending to try and look at some of this stuff, try to combine some of this stuff.
Cool. That would be great. I hope you get it.
I hope that works out.
Yeah.
What do you guys think of program induction?
I think it's tied up into the representation issue once again. And if you have a program, in some sense, can be run. And so that's, it gives it itself some sort of fitness function automatically because you just execute it. And I'll think that part of representation gives you the possibility of dynamism because you can just put a bunch together and run them one after the other. And all of a sudden you have a thing that's on. So I like that part of it an awful lot. Not sure that I would choose the kind of Bayesian programs that they choose. In some cases, I would rather just have a lambda expression or thunks or something.
Right. And their main problem, well, they have a couple problems, but one of their main problems is it's just computationally so expensive to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
You should have seen how much money they requested in our grant proposal for like compute.
Yeah.
we need like, you know, so much more money than like the neural net people.
You know, back in the day when I was running the letter spirit perception thing, I was eating all of the supercomputers alive at Indiana. Nobody else was using them. So I just made the code run on them all. And it was a lot of compute.
Right. Right. And So they can't do anything, you know, they can do things like this omniglot letter character stuff, but they can't do, it's hard for them to do more complex stuff because of the compute limitations for the search.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I think that's not, I think that's going to be that kind of almost exhaustive search thing is not going to work out in the end.
Right.
They seem to be saying in the Dream Coder paper that they had a little bit of a breakthrough in that area. I didn't understand this stuff at all. It's like programming language theory stuff, I think. But they were talking about the refactoring module being a huge improvement over their previous version.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, because you have subroutines, which is
right.
Critical. Remember when those got invented in BASIC, that was a big deal.
Go to, yeah.
Yeah, and then we got spaghetti code.
Woohoo! Yeah, I mean, so regarding when I think about the representation question and I think about the representation question around, you know, all of the approaches that we have, right? So, the structural mapping has the list of propositions and the tree and all that, you know, and copycat has its own sort of data structure associated with which representations, which concepts are active and so on. And program induction, of course, has sort of perhaps, in principle, or surface, a more general sort of like, we have, you know, some programming, we have a program as a representation. And then, you know, deep learning has, you know, a vector for everything. So going back to my earlier comment, that's the part that where I find all of the other approaches except for the deep learning approach to be a little bit more interesting in that they're approaching sort of, they're potentially using a larger class of mathematical objects, if you will, as candidates for the representation. And something that when I think about that problem, one of the questions that comes up in my mind is, well, are there some mathematical structures that could underpin all of the above, right? What is the mathematical structure that describes, you know, what copycat does, what refactoring does, the global match or the local match in SME does?
It seems to be structure, you know, to put it simply.
Yeah,
perhaps too simply.
I don't think so. You know, cramming structure into a neural network is a thing, right?
What do you mean?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not familiar enough with the details of all of the methodologies. But when I see some of the shortcomings around SME, I see that the notation, the Lisp notation, which is probably tied to the implementation, seems to sort of lead to this disjointness of the tree structure and the representation structure for what is it, attributes, properties, and so on. But what if it was all a graph? Like, what if we represented the tree, and what if everything was just, what if we used a notation built around graphs so that the whole thing would become a big graph? It seems like that would open up a different set of methodologies for achieving the matches, which could potentially overcome some of the examples that you include in the paper, like the problem with how is the notion of bridge represented in the Golden Gate example. Where in one case it's a sort of a three-part function, a three-argument function, and in the other case it's a two-argument function. Would that disappear if we had a sort of a different representation for for concepts themselves and attributes themselves? I don't know. I mean,
yeah. I see what you're saying. I think that, you know, one of the things some psychologists think that I've been influenced by is this notion of having a sort of simulatable model. So if you think about a bridge, you kind of simulate something in your mind that's like driving over a bridge or walking over a bridge or something, or making a bridge with your body. It's you actually have some thing that you can simulate. And that's
Is that related?
That's what the concept is.
Is that related to the embodiment ideas?
Well, it could be that, you know, some people argue that we can't get these, we can't learn these models without embodiment, you know, that we're sort of mapping everything onto bodily, physical things. Right. It doesn't necessarily require embodiment. That's kind of a debate, but it's like, you know, there's these, I don't know, you know, people like George Lakoff and Lawrence Barcelo and other psychologists like that, or cog sci people, talk about these internal models that we, you know, actually are based on experience. They're very embodiment type people, but and that we actually have to simulate. So,
well, then there's kind of another way of looking at it, which was in that paper that you pointed out from OpenAI, the symbolic behavior
from DeepMind.
And there's kind of an analog there to this notion of the fact that your representational system has to interact with something else's representational system in order to create meaning. And it's the mappings between the two that are the meaning part, that's some sort of weird social phenomenon. That seems to be getting somewhere to me.
Yeah, I agreed with that. you know, an isolated brain in a vat isn't going to have meaning in some sense.
So, I mean, I'd love to hear more about copycat in detail, or, you know, the things that you know that in one way or another are not, you know, easily extractable from what you've written about it, or so on. But then there's related to the relationship between a couple of these things. One of the things that catches my attention in the case of copycat is that the it has a set of primitive concepts that seem, if you will, sufficient to model the domain. You know, one of the sort of fundamental limitations of some of the other models is that if your vocabulary of sort of atomic elements is very large, then the computation will become intractable, or it will be very difficult to establish the structural comparisons, right? But if you have a limited vocabulary, then combinatorially it becomes a possibility to find these structural comparisons. So this relates to this concept of embodiment, or to the notion that, you know, somehow from the environment, somehow from the data, a set of primitive concepts must be extracted, and you know, before analogical, you know, intelligence can emerge. So I don't know, what are your thoughts on that crazy rambling?
So you know, and copycat has one of its concepts is successorship, right? Which is a very general concept. I could play my game that I played with the concept bridge, and I could like show you a bunch of different abstract examples of successorship that are increasingly abstract. And where does that come from? You know, that's a really good question. So there's this developmental psychologist named Liz Spelke who proposes that we're all sort of born with what she calls core knowledge systems. And one of those core knowledge systems is like sort of spatial geometry that's innate, that we can understand like something coming after something else. So she would say it's somehow evolution's like programmed that into us, and then we build on that. We have the ability to abstract from that. We recognize it in abstract ways.
That seems like only one step away from Pinker. It's just in there.
Well, you know, it perhaps that doesn't mean it's wrong. you know that you know, where do we get the concept of like an object, that the world is divided into objects? She claims that's innate, or at least we're, you know, maybe it's not there when we're born, but we're sort of programmed to learn it very easily.
Yeah.
That there are innate things. I mean, I'm not opposed to the, I think we have to have, there has to be something that's innate that we have to build off of.
Could it be something as kind of abstract as like minimum description length, kind of like algorithmic information theory kind of criteria, do you think, or no?
Well, minimum description length requires a language in which the thing is described.
And a vocabulary.
A vocabulary, yeah.
Yeah, so there's this other project that I've sort of been intrigued by, especially more recently when reading your work. There's this, they call it NSM, Natural Semantic Metalanguage. There's a group of people that have they're more like, it's a like cognitive / anthropological approach where they've tried to come up with these sort of semantic primitives that exist in many, many languages, you know? So there's like 30 languages that this project has been carried out on. And, you know, there are these common, they call them sort of undefinable semantic primitives that you can use to then sort of, and they have this other concept, explicate any other word. So Carol, the semantics of any word.
Are they tied up with physics the way Melanie was describing?
With physics?
Yeah, with the body, with being in
the finding, if you will, sort of the empirical finding is that, you know, all of these 30 languages that have been subjected will have an I and a you and a thing, and they have some prepositional things. They also have, you know, very basic causal things, some very basic timing things, like before. I mean, they might actually be more than one sort of abstract concept of succession. There's time, so there's time in it for sure. There's like before and there's after, short time. I think they have like 65, so the vocabulary up to now, and the project has been ongoing for about 30 years, goes up to like 60 some symbols, like, sorry, semantic primitives. It's funny and a little bit weird, and it doesn't really have a computational theory associated to it yet, right? It's like people, you know, linguistic anthropologists and people, they go and they analyze a few concepts and they try to sort of build these little programs. They look like little programs, or they look. Possibility of having children, and so on, and blah blah blah. I mean, we could talk about that.
Could you send a reference? I'd love to see that.
Of course. Yeah.
I don't know what happened to the recording, but my net just dropped, and then I came back. I don't know if you guys noticed that. Hopefully, it did.
I did notice. It said Gary McGraw is now host. Okay.
Who knows? Maybe it's going to be a very short recording of the very end of our conversation.
I just put a link in the chat to the Core Knowledge paper, which you guys might find interesting.
Cool, thanks.
Have you guys read this paper by Francois Cholet called On Measuring Intelligence or something like that?
Mm-mm.
I mentioned in my paper, this ARC data set. This is where he proposes it. It's a pretty interesting paper. I'll find the link and.
Is it that the On the Measure of Intelligence?
Yes.
In your, yeah, it's number 14 in Melanie's.
Yeah, page. That might be one that you guys might want to read sometime. It's okay. Pretty interesting.
So you know, one of the things that we're worried about is the kind of security engineering that's built or not built into these machine learning models. And
is there any built in?
There's not much built in, but obviously bias is a gigantic problem. Right. The thing that makes it interesting as a problem is that about 60% of the issue of risk is tied up in the data set, in how the data set, where it comes from, and who controls it, and all sorts of things like that, which is new for security, and kind of interesting. But one of the things that also interests me is this notion that we have for many years built universal computers, and then we get mad when they do certain things. We're like, damn, somebody made some malicious behavior. And the question is, well, why did your Coke machine a universal machine? Why isn't it just an 8-state machine? Because I could do that with 8 states, and then you couldn't really run very malicious stuff on it.
Right. Why is your refrigerator on the internet?
Yeah. And often the answer is because, you know, we had all these 8088 chips sitting around in a warehouse, and it's cheaper to put them in dishwashers than it is to store them in the warehouse. So I'm interested in how that, one other thing, one way to use that insight is to say, well, we're going to just shrink wrap programs so that you get as much capability as you need and no more. And that's what's known in Salzer and Schroeder as the principle of least privilege in some sense, but it could be the principle of least computation. And I'm interested to know whether something like that might apply to neural network land. In some sense, it might be better if we have artificial intelligence that can only do so much, and we keep it in a little shrink wrap thing. So where do the rules come from? What does constraining something like that mean?
Yeah, I've seen some work on. There's this whole set of work on this thing called the lottery ticket hypothesis in neural networks. I don't know if you guys have run into that. So the idea there is that you have some giant neural network, you initialize it with random weights, and then you have it learn. Okay, but what's actually happening is that there's some what they call a lottery ticket, which is some lucky subnetwork. Because you have such a big network, there's some lucky subnetwork that got the right weights that will allow it to learn the task. And all these other weights don't matter so much. And so what you can do is you can prune the network to just after the fact, because you don't know how to find it before the fact, but after the fact, you can prune it so that it's a much smaller network. And that smaller network might be less vulnerable to attack than the bigger network.
That seems related to TensorFlow and the tensor idea, where you just chop off the numerical representation that doesn't really matter. And you say, well, we're just going to say it's whole numbers and just drop everything after the dot.
Yeah. Because all these extra stuff, like the extra floating point, you know, decimals and the extra weights and stuff, open the network up to more vulnerability. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of a less, you know, minimum privilege kind of idea. Yeah. I don't know how much research has been done on the security aspects of it.
You know, the weird part about security in neural networks is it's just a tangled up mess, because most people are talking about using neural networks to do some security feature or function. And that's not what we're interested in. We don't care about that. Yeah.
No, but I mean, there's this whole area of like defense against adversarial attacks, right? That's kind of related to your thing.
We read a lot of that earlier on, didn't we?
Yeah, we did. David Wagner's work is what that is mostly.
It seemed like the kind of distillation idea, which I guess distinct from pruning, but similar, was like earlier approach that seemed to fall out of favor. And as far as I know, I think the best approaches are mostly based on adversarial training now, but I'm not really up to date. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know a whole lot about that area. I'm just sending you guys more links to this.
But, yeah, I think that was kind of the dynamic they found early on when everyone started studying the adversarial examples for neural networks. It's like everyone's like, oh, you just quantize it. You just distill it into a smaller model. But then they quickly found attacks that could beat that too. It seemed mm-hmm. to circumventable.
It all seems to be tied up to the notion of where do I want my network to sit in the overfit to generalization range? You know, what's the right amount of generalization? And that little slider seems to be related to this security issue that we're talking about. If it's overfit, it's going to be really susceptible to adversarial examples, probably. I don't know. That's the part about representation that I'm still trying to wrap my head around.
Well, I think it's worth thinking about this perceptual category versus concept distinction, because I would claim that if you learn perceptual categories, as you know, you're based on sort of perceptual features like a bridge, then you're more vulnerable because someone can like play around with pixels in a weird way, or put you in some weird pose in the image and fool you. Whereas if you have some more robust concept, then it's harder to fool you. That's a hypothesis.
And that's one kind of attack, and an important kind, yeah. But only one kind.
Right.
The fooling of people.
Not that you can't be fooled necessarily, but I think I lost everyone.
No, we're all here. We're just being
Everyone was just completely still.
Very quiet. Everybody was very still.
I was going to say, not that you can't be fooled, but at least it's computationally harder to fool you because you make more sophisticated mistakes.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, oftentimes security is about finding the assumptions that someone has made in their systems engineering and just removing those. And when you remove assumptions, often stuff just comes crashing down, and the assumptions are implicit. So people don't know that they have those assumptions. And when you make them go away, all of a sudden everything breaks, and that surprises them every time. So, you know, that.
Yeah, the same thing applies to tricking humans, right?
It is tricking humans. That's the.
Well, I mean, if like, you know, as computers aside, if I want to trick you, I figure out what your assumptions are.
Yeah. Like clicking on stuff is fun.
Right. Or that, you know, this kind of person is more trustworthy than another, right?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you guys want to see Copycat? I know Melanie has to go pretty soon in about 10
yeah,
minutes.
Yeah, I have to go in about 10 minutes probably.
So.
But I can show you a little demo that's in my talk. It's a movie. It's actually MetaCat, which is
Jim's thing.
An extension of Copycat that was written by Jim Marshall, who's another former Hofstadter student. Oh, let me just find, sorry. But it's Copycat, my version of Copycat doesn't run anymore, but his version, which was, where is it? Strangely enough, written in Scheme, does run. Okay, can you guys see that?
Yep.
All right, so you can see the workspace. I'm not showing the concept network here because there's too much to show, but if I run Copycat, you can see all these little codelets, which are these little lightning bolts, figuring out possible relationships, and they're interacting with the concept network. So stuff is getting activated and deactivated, and that's influencing what codelets do. The darker the line, the more sort of certain the program is that that's a good structure to build. And once it builds a certain kind of structure and it seems good, it tries to build more of those, like a group. Like once it builds PP, it says, oh, maybe QQ is a group too. And once it starts saying, well, maybe the letters correspond to groups, that keeps doing that. So there's like feedback, and you can see it comes up with its own representation and then figures out how to map the rule that it made into a translated rule. So that's sort of the idea of this dynamic unfolding of perception. And you kind of think about like your eye, you know, eye movements as being attracted to certain parts of the this situation. Anyway, that's my demo.
That's great.
I had a sort of a specific question about copycat, if we got a minute.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you ever tried like a version with sort of less prior, more data, where you give it like maybe one or two of these examples of the puzzle into the workspace, and there's less, like I remember from reading about it, there's quite a lot of sort of prior knowledge about like the puzzle domain. I feel like in the SlipNet, like it knows, it has like a depth and a strength of concepts and stuff a priori to try and make it look for kind of a clever solution as opposed to just a correct one.
Yeah. So I never had a version that learned from data. So that's something that's, you know, always kind of the next step.
Yeah. I mean, not necessarily as like an extra step learning, but I mean, just like, what if you put ABD or ABC, ABD, and then IIJJKK, IIJJGG, or LL, sorry, and then a third one into the workspace. So like sort of the same way you would prime GPT-3. And then over in the concept net, you have a little less prior, not like a little less information about what's a good solution to the puzzle. Like, does it kind of navigate that trade-off?
Yeah, no, I never did that. That would be another thing to try and do, to have it learn from examples of analogies, right?
Yeah, and you could you know, preset activations is one way to explore that in the concept net. So we're going to see stuff as along this dimension instead of that dimension. Predecessorship is more important than successorship, for example.
But yeah, you certainly like it to do this more, put it in a more kind of learning framework where you say, like GPT-3, where you give it an example and say, do the same thing as this example.
What was your general impression of the GPT-3 thing, you know, playing with it?
it's incredibly good and surprisingly good at doing stuff until it's bad.
Slippery slope to disaster.
Yeah.
Interesting.
But it's amazing. I mean, you know, when the stuff that it does well is really amazingly surprising.
Yeah, that's the impression that comes across when you haven't played with it as well, just watching other people play or seeing what results other people got.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering how it was like to actually do it.
Yeah, it's really fun to kind of watch it, see kind of what it can do. It's a fun thing to play with. It's frustrating that you know, you're given this interface, but you can't, what you're allowed to kind of, the parameters you're allowed to play with are very limited. Hmm. So you can't go in and like look under the hood and figure out what's going on. Hmm. It's not, because you know, it's a commercial product now, so they're not letting you see what, they're not releasing anything.
Yeah.
Open AI.
Yeah, it's not.
Well, exactly. They used to be open AI. Now they're not anymore. That's pretty well explained in Cade's book, which by the way, you should probably read. I liked Cade's book pretty well.
Which book is that?
The Genius Maker one.
Oh, Cade's book. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I do want to read that.
I was surprised that it didn't suck, to tell you the truth.
Well, it's not a book about how AI systems work. It's a book about the people, right?
Yeah, and it's incredibly well researched and pretty, you know, nicely situated. It's uh-huh. not it's not just hyperbole and nonsense and rumor.
It's so kind of the history of deep learning and all these people, right?
A little bit, yeah. I think you'd like it. I was surprised. I was like, although I know I've known Cade for many years, and so I'm in retrospect, I should have known, well, if he was going to write it, it would be good.
Yeah, I've read some of his stuff in New York Times, and some of it's good. Some of it, I think, oh, come on. Give me
Well, usually what happens in those popular press books is you always think just, oh, God, come on. You can't, what? And his was like that.
Well, okay, before I leave, I'm going to do, let me see. I'm looking for this link where David Chalmers wrote about GPT-3 because I think you'll love that.
Okay.
Or you'll hate it or something on GPT-3. Oh, yeah.
What was it in?
It's in some web thing. Here, I'm going to just chat the link to you guys.
Thanks.
Yeah. So it's a fun read. It's Chalmers and some other philosophers talking about what they think about GPT-3.
Cool. Well, listen, thanks very much for taking the time to meet with us. We've been having fun.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Ideas, and it's really good to talk about them outside of our bubble.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
Yeah, it's just great.
See you all hopefully in person someday.
Yeah. All right. You guys stick around for a second. So
bye-bye.
See you later, Melanie.
Okay. Bye.